Welcome to Questions in Sustainability, a science-based podcast series that explores programs, people, and ideas in sustainability of food systems. I am Professor Paul Vincelli from the University of Kentucky, and I'm your host today. And we've got a guest that's going to talk about something that for years I've wondered about, but didn't have very much information on. So this is kind of exciting for me. I mean, this goes back to graduate student days, so I'm looking forward to the topics. Before I introduce our guests, I do want to say we appreciate all our guests who offer their time and expertise to Questions in Sustainability. And of course, the views expressed by our guests, or by yours truly for that matter, do not necessarily represent those of the University of Kentucky. So with that, having said that, let me introduce our guest, who is Dr. Dawn Thelmany from Colorado State University. And Dawn, welcome to Questions in Sustainability.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
So, Dawn, just for the benefit of our listeners, I'll give some credentials here that I think are very impressive. And Dawn is a professor and associate department head at the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at Colorado State University. And then I'll just mention a few of the highlights from her career, but there's quite a notable number of things that I think are impressive. And she currently serves as the CSU Colorado State University Regional Economic Development Institute Associate Director. You are an adjunct professor at Colorado State, Colorado School of Public Health, Farm Foundation Fellow for Rural Community Viability. You've had several appointments with the USDA, it appears, or at least one, the Interim Program Leader for Organics at the USDA in Washington, D.C. And I think I mentioned the visiting scholar at USDA's Economic Research Service. Actually, I did not mention that, so I'm glad I did that. So her background really prepares her for the kind of work she does, and we're only going to talk about a portion of it, but that portion certainly interests me. So Dawn, the topic, again, that I've seen associated with you is co-ops. So for the benefit of our listeners, what are co-ops?
Cooperatives are a type of business organization that still allows a group of people to coalesce like they would in a business, but unlike a business where there's a clear ownership structure and then a set of employees and customers, I guess probably the key tenet of cooperatives is the fact that they try to be more democratic by having most of the people who do business with the business actually be owners of the business. So that's real atypical. Usually you think of there being a business that's owned downtown on Main Street, but cooperatives are where the people who wanted to do business with a business actually want to be the owners of the business as well. Sometimes that's because of just their sheer interest in being a part of the solution of bringing a business to their community. Sometimes it's because they want more democratic control of how that business makes decisions. Some people believe it helps make for stronger communities. Some people feel like it gives more independence and not just one owner making the decisions, but a set of people who all would benefit from a business making the decisions. But basically it's something the United States encouraged and has allowed for over 100 years now, so that people who want to bring democratic principles to industry can also do so.
You know, one of the questions that has always puzzled me about co-ops, and when I was a graduate student in Orange County, New York, a major area of vegetable production in the eastern U.S., I was always puzzled by how and why weren't co-ops particularly common? Because the ability to pool resources and get a price that's consistent with the co-op's bargaining power, it always seemed like a good idea, and yet it wasn't. Most of the onions were sold, you know, just directly from the grower to the next person in the supply chain. Are co-ops common in some parts of the United States,
It's quite uneven. So some places and some sectors, we have a lot of co-ops. So still, if you look at how a large set of producers obtain most of their input supplies. It's through a co-op system that's very strong, particularly in the Midwest, where because no one customer buys enough fertilizer or other gas or chemicals they might need to be a very big customer, you saw groups of dozens or hundreds of producers get together and form input buying co-ops where there would be one place relatively close to them all, because the other challenge for a lot of producers is they're in rural areas where they aren't close by businesses. They would assure they'd be close by business by actually forming a cooperative of people who all lived and farmed near each other to buy those. And that's the co-op my family belonged to growing up. Then the one that's more common because it's more visible is where we have co-ops people can buy from. So of course, there's still retail cooperatives out there for food retailers where you can not just be a customer of a store, you can be a member owner of the store and get to help make decisions about what the store carries and what the store does strategically. And those are relatively common still, particularly in the Midwest. We have one here in Fort Collins, Colorado. And then we also, in some parts of the country, have co-ops that work on the other end of the supply chain. And instead of buying inputs together, they sell their outputs together. So probably the ones that are most famous, everyone's heard of, is Sunkist Oranges, Blue Diamond Almond Growers. Oh. So that's where the U.S. government gave those producers permission. Because if you think of what a co-op does, some of it almost sounds illegal under antitrust law. They let these producers get together and decide on prices together. Well, the U.S. government decided to let us do that and actually encourage that in ag industry. In the last time we had a lot of antitrust concerns, which was in the early 1900s under Teddy Roosevelt, because they wanted farms to actually compete well against what looked like bigger agribusinesses. So actually those were encouraged and allowed in agriculture. California probably has the widest swath of those that come together and sell their products together. But again, they're across the country. And then you have a smattering of other co-ops, everything from labor and worker co-ops to childcare co-ops to housing co-ops. I would say for all the benefits they bring and that I started with in this conversation, the grand challenge is coordinating lots of owners is hard. Kind of goes back to the how many cooks do you want in the kitchen? It's great to have this democratic set of owners who all get to make decisions. But when you need to bring dozens or hundreds of people into a room and have them all agree on a decision, that's not quite as easy as one owner just making a decision after looking at some numbers and deciding what they wanted to do. So I would say it's somewhat the independence of Americans that's actually made co-ops also very quite hard, because people just want to make a decision and go. And when you have to get agreement or at least democratic majority, that's a little bit harder. And so that might slow down some business decisions that need to be made quickly.
It's interesting that you say that. I didn't know if this was a stereotype or what, but I guess I have a sense that Americans in general are independent people who certainly lean that way in lots of ways. And given our history, I think that's not natural. And I just wondered if it was an independence thing. You know, I want to make my own choice about the price that my onions are worth. You know, so. So you mentioned do co-ops help smaller farmers more than, say, the middle size or large scale farmers? Because that's an interesting question from the standpoint of sustainability.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's been actual research done on this, but if you just think about one of the benefits of a co-op being the ability to give better negotiating power to a large set of producers, obviously small producers are going to relatively benefit from that, because where one of the reasons being small is harder is you just don't have negotiating power. You don't buy enough from anybody to negotiate well the terms of trade. You don't sell enough to anybody to really feel like you have the leverage to ask for better prices. And so if you think about it, the people who are going to benefit most from that collaborative nature of ownership and giving good trades, terms of trade, it is going to be probably smaller producers. But that said, because you want a co-op to be big enough to be influential and have good trade terms, it really sure helps when there's bigger producers involved as well. And again, some of those names I threw out, like Sunkissed Oranges and Blue Diamond Almond Growers, certainly have some big producers involved as well. Because when you start thinking of how big our economy has become and how big the grocery store chains you have to negotiate with, or perhaps international trade partners, you know, a lot of our almonds get shipped to other parts of the world. You need to be relatively big to actually have that seat at the table to be considered in conversations and be able to build your case for the value of your product.
Yeah, good. Boy, that's an interesting aspect already that I didn't even think to ask about, but yeah, the size. And the reason why that's of particular interest to me in this moment is I recently did a podcast on it was on yield intensification. You know, of course, greater yield per unit area, uh-huh. And what has been the effect of that over time on rural communities? And Doug Constance was the guest, and it was really good and enlightening for me. As a natural scientist, and so I'm sort of maybe more attuned to paying attention to the social dimensions of these social issues. So the idea that it, not by design necessarily, but just by natural consequence, that the co-ops would maybe give some benefit to small farmers. That's an interesting, it's an interesting aspect. So one of the things I'd like to do, Dawn, is find out more about our guest. And so how can we know you better here with respect to your profession? How did you get into working on co-ops, or if you even want to go back earlier, how did you get into agricultural economics? Just something that helps us know who you are better.
Well, great question. I grew up on a farm in Iowa in a time where we were in the middle of a farm crisis. So when you're the child of a farmer, you know exactly what your parents do for business because it's the thing that's talked about at the lunch table every day. And so we watched markets, you know, you were just kind of infused with everything that was going on the farm because that's what your parents talked about because it was not just your family business, but where you lived. So, you know, I did a lot of the typical farm youth activities like 4-H, FFA, then it was called the Future Farmers of America, and always knew I wanted to stay working with agriculture and picked up just enough of what was going on around our farm to kind of know where some of the challenges were. My dad did, again, belong to a co-op on the input side, but not on the output side. And so when prices were volatile or low, you know, we really struggled as a farm too. But I also was always a big fan of math. And the first time I took an economics class, I just kind of discovered this is what I like. This is how I think. This is how I analyze things. So was encouraged once I finished my degree at Iowa State to go on and keep learning. So went to the University of California, Davis for grad school. And I went from a state that had about 5 crops and products it produced to one that had 95, many of which, like I listed before, used cooperatives as part of their marketing strategy. So that was a whole new look at cooperatives I had not understood before, was fascinated by that. And so clearly now that I'm at Colorado State, I ended up halfway back home. I didn't make it quite back to Iowa. But it's interesting because Colorado has parts of the state that look a lot more like California and parts of the state that look a lot like Iowa. So I got to be in a state that has lots of interesting dimensions, including an active, we have a co-op development center out of the Rocky Mountain Farmers Union, and we partner with them sometimes. But I guess what's really interesting is I certainly work with co-ops, but there's even quite a few organizations out there of producers now who decided not to formally be a co-op, because that gets pretty legalistically specific and pretty formal to structure, but they still take some of those principles of cooperative operations and instill them even if they're a private owned business. So maybe the owner doesn't, not everyone doing business with that business gets to be an owner and make all the decisions, but perhaps they have an advisory board or a set of membership meetings where people take people's input and take it very seriously without formally going all the way to making those people a part of their ownership structure. So what's been really interesting to see is how cooperatives work, but also how the diversity of types of businesses in the food supply chain now, some of which just adopt some of the principles of co-ops without formally becoming a co-op, partly because again, it's a balancing act of how much independence they want to keep versus how much flexibility they're gonna give up by having 123 owners. And a lot of people arrive somewhere in between, where they want a little bit of both. And so they won't become a formal co-op, but they'll, sometimes they're called food hubs. Sometimes you've probably heard of community supported agriculture, where in theory, the buyers own a share of the farm and sometimes get to have a say in like what kind of crops are in their boxes and so forth. But there's all kinds of different models that have emerged, and it's just been fun and fascinating to see how differently they perform.
Yeah, so here's a question that just, you know, comes to me on the fly here as I listen to you. What do you find most exciting about the work you're doing? Because I can tell you're excited.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm always impressed with the entrepreneurial spirit of the average U.S. business owner. So what gets me excited is, you know, sometimes we have this human inclination to throw our hands up and say, I don't know what to do here. Prices aren't good, not making money. I don't know what to do. I totally get it. The number of challenges an average farm and food business face are just remarkable. But what's really exciting is when you get that subset, and they're the ones who commonly do reach out to the universities for help, who say, I want to try something new. That what I'm doing right now is not working. I want to try something new. And helping brainstorm with those farmers, ranchers, food business owners, how they might be able to improve on what they're doing, secure better prices, treat their workers better. There's a variety of challenges that come up, and you getting to be at the table occasionally when they invite you to help them brainstorm with that, and just being impressed in what you learn from them about how they think through problems, how they solve those problems, and how they analyze whether it worked for them or not.
Yeah, that is pretty exciting. I think it sounds like you're using your creativity to address the challenges that they come with. And there's nothing that, you know, nothing better than that than coming up with new ideas or new variations of old ideas or recalling old ideas that might work. You know, those can be quite exciting experiences. So, let's take a short break. I usually have a break here at this point on, and it's going to be very short. Sometimes 30 seconds, sometimes not. But I like to introduce a little bit of music to help the listeners sort of refresh the mind. And I'm a musician myself, so I just consider that an important part of the sustainability issues that face us. And when we come back, folks, we'll be listening to Dr. Dawn Filmoni speak about co-ops, and I've got some more things I want to learn. So please stick around, and we'll be back shortly. Welcome back to Questions in Sustainability. And I'm Paul Vincelli, your host from the University of Kentucky. And we once again welcome Dr. Dawn Thilmany from Colorado State University, who's an expert in co-ops and other economic models in agriculture. And Dawn, once again, it's been a pleasure to have you, and thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
So, there's a number of things we could go into. One is sustainability. So to remind our listeners, there are three pillars to sustainability, at least as understood by many authors. There's the economic vitality or profitability, without which there are no farmers. And there's also stewardship. Usually we think of the environment. And third is quality of life. And that one, I will say, a lot of us natural scientists don't think about as much as we should. So, but those are the three pillars. Obviously, co-ops play to the economic vitality or profitability pillar. Where do co-ops have an impact, if any, on the other two, the stewardship and the quality of life pillars?
Well, I guess, you know, what we tend to think of is that America was built on strong businesses and markets where part of how businesses grew and were successful was their efforts to grow sales, grow profits, and follow the bottom line. But as we became a richer country and people started realizing, okay, well, I have enough money now to securely buy a house, feed my family, give them what they need. What other things matter to me? And as you said, the environment or stewardship and quality of life or how we treat people became increasingly important. So you saw a number of ways that businesses started to try to build that sustainability concept into their business. For cooperatives, that makes sense because again, with those people you're serving actually being your owners, you keep them top of mind simply because they help own the business and run the business. So they are top of mind. And if they're aligned in their values and vision and environmental sustainability is important to all of them, it's easier to make decisions. Because for instance, let's say, okay, well, we could use solar energy instead of the typical utilities, but it's gonna cost us a bit more money. So we'll lose, you know, let's say $12,000 of our profits for this year. Well, if everybody who belongs to that co-op agrees, it's really important for them to use sustainable energy sources, and they all agree they're willing to lose that share of their profits, then they can all come to an agreement. Well, someone who owns a typical business where that's going to affect their household or their stockholders, that's a harder decision to make because it's less likely perhaps that everybody has the same values. So co-ops oftentimes bring together with people with the same values. But we also even see corporations now who actually have made commitments to the environment or their workers and so forth because they do have a share of stockholders who it's really important to. Like you have whole investment funds now that only invest in sustainable businesses. So I would say corporations in some way have caught up with that. But I would say sometimes it's less easy to believe because they're still guided by what their stock price is doing in any one day. And with a co-op, that's not the case. And I'd say the other thing that is interesting with a cooperative model is some people would say it's just sustainable by nature because when you have the people who do business with the business and who live by the business and the community with the business worried about how their community is served by, say, a food store or a co-op, they're just going to keep it more sustainable because they're seeing it every day. Whereas if you think of a major corporation, no one is seeing every day how that operation affects where that business does business. So co-ops just tend to be more community driven just by definition. But I would say corporations have made gains there too. The other thing I would say about cooperatives is that they're less at the whims of trends and so forth. And again, sometimes people get too excited about something new that might be great or might save them a dollar or might help the bottom line. And co-ops, because they do have to get, you know, dozens or hundreds of members to agree, tend to not sway quite so quickly. That said, when we teach any class, I'm an economist, we still say having all those other goals of stewardship and treating people well is great. But if your bottom line is not healthy, you have to be operating well as an operation first so that you're not stressed about paying bills and making it. Once you get that bottom line healthy, then you can talk about those broader things and perhaps have a little less profitable of a bottom line, but still your first thing you have to worry about is staying in business in the long run, which is making sure your bottom line is sound. And that's true for co-ops too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Boy, wow. I thought that'd be a tough question for you, but it was tough for me, but it was easy for you. You had a lot of things to say. I've been furiously taking notes. So it's wonderful. Very good. I did want to ask you what have we left out here to end soon, and what do we need to talk more about?
I think one thing that's been really interesting is I don't think anyone missed the news that COVID was particularly impactful on food markets in the United States. First of all, of course, the big shift where everybody quit eating out. And so we had a lot more people eating at home and going to grocery stores. The grocery stores weren't quite ready for that. So in some cases, we saw food run out, even though there was plenty of food out there, it was kind of in the wrong places at the wrong time. And then as people did buy differently, it had ripple effects all the way from, all of a sudden the local bakery or butcher shop being way busier to not being enough plants around the country to slaughter cattle or pork. And in all those cases, I think co-ops have been brought up as an example of how we might be able to fix that. I'm not sure that's always the case, but, you know, I think what people did become aware of is we've been very spoiled as a country that food has always been there when we wanted to buy it, in the way we want to buy it, where we want to buy it, at the price we want to buy it. And that perhaps is more fragile and delicate than we knew. And so there's a renewed interest in, do I want to have a better stake, say, idea of where I would get my full set of food I need for my household if things got any more severe than what we saw this year. Luckily, you know, we were pretty resilient. The U.S. pulled out of that pretty quickly, but it certainly got people thinking who never think about where they get their food about it a bit more. We definitely have heard from a lot of small independent grocers and cooperative grocers. They have seen increased and sustained business. We thought at first that might be because they were smaller stores and maybe felt less risky, but now we think it's, again, some people going, hey, I need to make sure I have a local grocer here if the big ones can't secure everything they're used to securing. And we're even hearing now lots of different examples of other food businesses, again, either starting as cooperatives or using at least some of the cooperative principles to bring themselves together to come up with new solutions for what's going on in their county, their city, their region, their state. The geography differs a lot depending on the topic you're talking about. But I think whether it's through actual formal cooperative development or just using the principles of cooperatives, we are going to see a lot more activity in the food and agriculture space that leans heavily into thinking about solutions that are more sustainable, more resilient, more customer friendly, more farmer friendly, more worker friendly. There is a lot of public issues that surround food and agriculture that got a lot more attention. And I don't think that's going to fade as quickly, partly because this was just such a substantial event and it lasted so long.
You've just got so many things that I haven't really thought much about. Let me ask a question here about consumers who are interested in food. My daughter's one, for example. She doesn't grow food. She buys the food. She eats like I do. But she, you know, she likes food. She knows a lot about food. She's amazing. What advice do you have for people, for consumers, you know, who are just interested in food? Any thoughts from your work that would inform consumer groups like that?
Yeah, usually the handful of things I recommend is you certainly can't do it for the entire set of foods you eat in a day or meals you create in your house, but you know, pick a handful of things where for you the quality really matters. For some people, that's fruits and vegetables. For some people, that's dairy. For some people, that's meat. For some people, that's their beverages. And just pick a few of those that you either choose to research and investigate the nature of the companies or farmers or ranchers that make that available. If there's ways you can support the ones that are doing things that align with your own values. And that value can even include just giving you a quality product. It's okay to be selfish and just want a really good product. But I usually tell people to like pick a couple of things where you just think a little harder about where you get it, are you getting the best, and how can you support the best? And that's something we do in our household. Second, I would say is for people to be more adventurous and just try a wider swath of foods. We as a country picked up eating a lot of really highly processed foods as a kind of habit. And one thing COVID did positively is it gave people more time at home to learn how to cook again. And we saw people be far more exploratory. Part of that is because, again, when we as a country had a goal of just getting ourselves fed back in the world wars, we kind of almost oversimplified food choices by just making some common things that we knew we could always make available to people. Well, now we're back into an era where we are pretty affluent and we can make a lot more choices, but we had already kind of lessened the choices we had to make. The example everyone always thinks of is craft brews. We were down to 4 or 5 major brands of beer that I at least saw when I was in college. Well, then there was this renaissance again where it made sense for people to start doing smaller mid-sized batches and get a play around with flavor profiles and whole types of beer from perhaps even the country they were ethnically from, that they could try that again. And I think we've seen the same thing happen in food. So just people should be more open-minded. And then I would last say there is nothing wrong with big food companies either. There's some great small food companies, some great big food companies. But given it is one of the few things in our life we do 3 times a day on average, which is eating and drinking, you know, it is worth knowing a little bit more on average about if the people you're doing business with are good citizens or not, because we do it so frequently. And so just like I want people to go and support the ones they really believe in, also make sure you're not doing business with anyone, and it's really rare now, who's making some choices that you don't agree with and that are not as good of actors, because in almost every food category I can think of, we have lots of good choices. Again, another good example is everybody was buying the same coffee when I was growing up. Everybody had Folgers or Maxwell House and had no idea where it came from. Well, Starbucks and many, many other roasteries now have really brought back taking better care of the coffee producers in different parts of the world who make sure we have good products. So lots of different ways you can kind of be a baby activist in this space.
Yeah, and give us good results too. So I can't resist asking this. Just a real brief answer because we're running out of time, Dawn. But I want to get this one in. For students, what would you tell them?
For students, again, pick one food business and be their biggest fan and support them and give great word of mouth to them and use your social media to drive other people to them. You influencers are the new generation of marketers out there, and this young generation has got that down pat. Be an influencer for good.
Oh, okay, thanks, Dawn. Before I leave you, I'll explain to the benefit of the listeners as well that I've adopted the habit of introducing a piece of music at the end of every program, and if the music stands on its own, it's something that I idiosyncratically decide fits the topic and it may not for anybody else, but But I sure enjoy the process. And so I'm going to paste something at the end of the interview and a piece of music of some sort. And I don't know what it'll be yet. But if you have any thoughts, I don't know which direction I'll go in, but I'd sure be interested in hearing yours. If you have any on the way home or some other time, shoot me an email. But it's important to, I guess I want to say the reason I do that, it's important as a reminder to the natural scientists like myself that quality of life is important in this process too. And we tend to forget that, as we mentioned before, in the natural sciences. We're just thinking about, the details of our work. It's not anything more than that. But I like to remind myself with this piece of music that quality of life is part of this sustainability issue. So you'll look for that at the end of the interview.
Well, it's been great having this discussion with you today, and I look forward to hearing your piece of music.
Excellent. Thanks. Yeah, so we're speaking with Dawn Thelmany from Colorado State University, an expert in co-ops and other economic models. And Dawn, it's been a pleasure. I'm really glad you joined us. Folks, thanks again for listening to Questions in Sustainability. I'm your host, Paul Vangeli from the University of Kentucky, and I hope you'll join us again.